Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode on New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee. In today's episode, we welcome back Dr. Thomas Conlon from Princeton University. He recently published a new book, Kings in All But Name, The Lost History of Oji Rule in Japan, 1350 to 1569. Through Oxford University Press. This book begins with an examination of the Oji family in Japan in the 14th century and expands into discussing problems of trade, urbanization, religion, and multi-ethnicity in early modern and modern Japan. So welcome back, Tom. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, thank you, Jingyi. I'm delighted to be here. And thanks for taking the time for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Since it's been a while, could you refresh our memory again about what you do, what you research, what you teach about?
Sure. So I'm a professor of ancient medieval Japanese history at Princeton University. And really, my research tends to focus on the 13th through the 16th centuries, though I do a wider range. And I'm very much interested in ongoing processes, be they trade or warfare or rituals, and how they influence political, cultural, and social developments.
So what is this new book about? And could you give us a brief overview of the Oji history and their significance in Japanese history? I don't assume a lot of our listeners would be very familiar with the story, and I myself don't know this family very well. So who were they and what did they do?
Well, thank you. No, the Oji were a family of Korean immigrants who came to Japan probably in the 5th, 6th century. And over the course from the 14th through the 16th century, they became the most powerful lords of all of Japan. They did this because of primarily through their control over trading networks. They also had access to mines. And as a result of that, they did several, they upheld Japan's court. And they really, I guess what I'm arguing, they created a city in Western Japan, which kind of functioned as a segmented polity that was sort of connected to the capital of Kyoto. They were violently destroyed in a coup in the mid 16th century. And in the aftermath of that, a lot of Japan's successor polities and regimes kind of had an interest in forgetting certain aspects of the rule. So there was actually really an attempt to sort of erase their history. And so that's why I'm trying to sort of bring back what's known as a lost history here.
There are several points that you mentioned that I do want to come back to later, like you mentioned of the capital and why their history was almost wiped. But how did this project begin? Seeing how it differed from your previous Well, it kind of continued, but extended from your previous project. And I was very curious, what was the research process like for a research topic on this time period, and what difficulties you might have run into during the research process?
Thank you. So actually, I first visited, there's a city in West Japan called Yamaguchi, which actually the New York Times put as like the top three tourist destinations for the world this year. I mean, so, and when I went there was this pagoda, and it's a 5-story pagoda, and it's the most beautiful thing that I had seen. And it was so large and so majestic. And what surprised me is that I knew this was by this Ōuchi family, which again, there's one book by Peter Arneson about them, and they really seemed like a failure, you know, and so they really aren't famous. Their successors are more famous. And yet when I looked at this pagoda, I thought, this is as spectacular as anything you see in Kyoto, and I want to know more about it. And the fact that they had a city in the 14th century, which other people didn't do, there's all these things. So this professor gave me a good tour, and in 1995, I decided I'm going to write something about them. So I start accumulating sources, and from that time, I did other books. I think, you know, I finished my dissertation on warfare. Then I did Sovereign Symbol, where I talked about the importance of the political importance of ritual. And once I finished that, that's when I moved into the Ōuchi project. I really started this in earnest around 2011, when I received a Japan Foundation grant. And when I went there, I mean, my assumption was, I really want to look at a family that doesn't have an overwhelming amount of sources. Because before my previous work, I dealt with a temple called Daigoji, which has 800 boxes and like probably close to 100,000 documents. I wanted something small. And what I found, and I wanted to talk about a conservative family that can't react to the times and fails. That was kind of the story. I got this out of Morgan Padelka, and there was David Spafford, and there was a conference in Princeton in 2009, and Morgan's book came out, but I was really influenced at the time. Let's just really go forward with this project of kind of destruction and failure. And as I'm there, I find more and more sources, and then I visit these areas, and then I just started realizing that, in fact, despite their destruction, an amazing amount of material survived. And in Yamaguchi itself, the archives are just thousands of documents, and there was like a prefectural history that was written. And then I suddenly had access to a lot of these sources, but then I also, there's a lot of archaeological developments. And so that's where I just kept building. And in the end, I wrote a book that's 450 pages. So so it wasn't small. And what I also found was, instead of being reactive, that these were people who were actually really the engines of change, and that they changed Japan in many ways, and their destruction also caused Japan to go on a very different path. And so instead of just being a peripheral figure, I really start to see them as becoming the central figures of Japan's middle age.
Fascinating. And just for a glimpse into this research process, what kind of historical documents do you use for studying about the 14th century?
Well, if you go back to 14th century, there are a lot of written records. So that warriors that are fighting, they have petitions. They'll write about things. Certain of the protagonists will write memos. They actually have, like, the Ōuchi have these rituals that were performed every year by all their participants, and everyone would sign these documents, and all that survives. And so that's probably the one of the remarkable things. The other thing is the archaeological evidence. So, for example, there's a mortuary temple, and it has Korean style roof tiles in Korean kingly style. And those tiles were made by a Korean craftsman in Yamaguchi in the 14th century. And we know that because it's Korean artisanship, but Yamaguchi soil. So that's another thing that I found really sort of surprising. And just going on as you go into the 15th and 16th century, there's just so many records of various families, and also major temples and shrines, and also court archives. And the Ōuchi appear basically everywhere, which is surprising.
Fascinating. And you've mentioned that the Ōuchi family originally came from Korea. Since we our listeners may not be familiar with the geographical landscape of the 14th century and onwards, Can we maybe talk about the background of this time? So where were they mainly located at first? I guess how did they even come to Japan? And how I'm more also interested in how did the geographical location connect with their trades and foreign policies at the time?
So the Oishi strongholds is in Western Japan. It's net, and there's like a city called Yamaguchi, but there's also a prefecture called Yamaguchi, which is confusing. But it's the western tip of the main island of Honshu, and it's actually probably the closest to Korea. It's about 120 miles from Korea. And what's the currents are such that if someone from like Busan were to just get on a boat, they would kind of float to this region or the region called Shimane, which is slightly to the east. So it's very close, and there's lots of movement of people and exchanges of people, and they're going back and forth. And the Oishi, you know, there's a lot of Korea and ancient Korea, there's turmoil because different states were vying for contention and some were destroyed. And so a lot of these Korean refugees would go, because this is before there was a Korea, you know, there were these different states. And so like one of the states is called Pekche, those people would flee to Japan. And the Oishi were clearly like, they were metallurgists, because their surname Tatara means bellows, like for blowing, to get high temperatures and all that. And what it seems is that they were there in the West, and they weren't that prominent, but they were just like of important sort of local family, but really pretty minor. And it wasn't really until the mid 14th century, with the Civil War, where you had one sort of genius commander who was able to defeat his rivals and then just actually conquer some regions in the West, and then that put their status at a very different level. And at that moment, what's really interesting is that that's when they start reaching out to Korea to say, hey, we heard that we actually have a really important status because we're descended from Korean kings. And at that time, there was a new dynasty in Korea called the Joseon Dynasty that just came into power. And they said, oh, well, yes, it looks like you are related. And so then you kind of have this exchange between the Oishi and officials in Joseon Korea, where they keep asking for more detail. And so over the 14th and 15th centuries, this becomes more elaborate. And the irony is that there was a family that is called the King of Pekche House. And Pekche was one of these old Koreans that collapsed. And actually, the crown prince was in Japan. And that family, it still exists, but it was really important because they were thought to be like the kings of this state and treated as kings. So that even some of Japan's emperors, like Kamu, intermarried with them, and they would have major positions. So one, they were like called prefectural governors. So one was governor in the north when they discovered gold. Another was a governor in the west. And so these Oishi, they had this person as their governor way back in the past. So they kind of remembered it, but then they just sort of, started conflating their genealogy with that genealogy. And so the irony is that this is something which is basically sort of fabricated over time. At a certain point, the Oishi realized that they were mistaken. And this is mid-16th century, because they look at these old records and found out that, oh, no, we're not that family. And so then they slowly start to de-emphasize their kingly descent. And they emphasize the fact that, well, this king was descended from the stars, so we're descended from stars. So you could see this recalibration, but they never negate their origins. And the other thing that's interesting is even they created this temple, as I mentioned before, with Korean kingly roof tiles. And they had this for well over a century. So they would try to restore it, and the Japanese craftsmen couldn't do it. So a Korean phoenix becomes this really cute looking dove, you know what I mean? Because they didn't know how to make these tiles. But clearly, there's having manifest displays of the fact that they are of a different ethnicity, and that was fine with everyone in Korea and Japan. And why this mattered was more this idea that being of a kingly status was more important than where your origins were. So it's very different from later understandings of ethnicity and the role of people in these two states.
That is so interesting. And how did they get along with the Japanese warring court and the warriors, I guess, the warrior rank at the time?
Well, they were very powerful lords themselves in their own right. And so what happened was is that in the mid 14th century, in the Civil War, they amassed a lot of support. And I would say that They had control, they gained control over silver and copper mines very early. So that gave them a wealth that a lot of others did not have. And so they were known as being very militarily effective in a lot of times. And they were known as being, you know, some would say they're of a different ethnicity, you know what I mean? That they're basically, so, you know, one quarter would say they're not Japanese, but then later he changed his mind. But generally, they functioned indistinguishably from a lot of the other warrior groups, excuse me, except that they basically overpowered them, and they had more troops at their disposal, and they were able to, you know, to basically defeat them or resist the center if it came to that. And that's probably what's unusual, really, I'd say.
Fascinating. And one thing you mentioned from the beginning of your book is the status of agriculture in discussions of pre-modern Japan. And in this book, you focused, well, for a part, you focused a lot on the mining trades. Mm-hmm. So what was the significance or the economic and social status and importance for mining resources in medieval Japan?
Well, I think that, you know, when people think of East Asian history, it's like, you know, they make jokes, it's the rice paddies, everything about rice and everything like that. And we always assume, you know, oh, okay, the basis of agriculture is rice, and that's the basis of wealth and everything else. And this area in the West is, especially some of the where they have the mines, they don't rely on as much agriculture. And what struck me was the fact that they were so much involved with trade, and that they had wealth beyond the imagination of other figures. I mean, I'll come back to this, but we even know in their wells, they had gold-plated plates that they would just throw away. It was not, you know, so why is that? It's that they had control over certain mines, and through the trade, they could get access to resources of whatever they wanted. And the trade was, we know that, you know, that when you'd send copper to a place that would want the copper, and what you get back in terms of silk, and then you could exchange that. It was lucrative beyond imagination. So that when the Ouchi would send one ship over, and like today's currency, it's like around $1 million of profit. So they didn't need agriculture. They didn't have to rely on that. They would instead just get whatever they wanted, and through these various transactions then purchase what they wanted. And so that's, I think what I'm really trying to go against, because often people think that, oh, you have old agriculture villages and everyone's isolated and they don't have these exchanges. And this idea that Japan is a place that is relatively isolated from the rest of the world. And what I've really found is that's not the case at all. It's just, you have to focus more on the West. And once you realize that, you see that it is highly integrated with you know, particularly Japan, particularly Korea, but also China. And probably one of the interventions of my work is that I do feel that the durability, the strength and depth of the Japanese-Korean ties are underestimated. And so that's probably one of the things that surprised me the most, is just how closely tied they are to the Korean court, and how Korea is also very much, you know, in close communication with them, diplomatically, economically, and culturally. And so I actually think that the Ouchi probably could understand Korean, and there was a flawless exchange, really, in both languages. And, you know, the Korean court would give them whatever they wanted, because the Korea needed copper and the Ouchi had access to mountains of copper. So that's why, even though the trade is important, the Ouchi had something that everyone wanted, and that also facilitated these exchanges.
It would be really cool if we can find documents or historical materials in Korea that may have mentioned their trades with the Ouchi family. Just a thought that came to mind.
Yeah, no, and some of them do. Actually, they do. They will mention, the Ouchi appear hundreds of times in the Korean official records, and the Koreans recognize them as being of a kingly family. And so sometimes, like, this is even before the Portuguese come, there's an account that says, we received several tons of silver from the Ouchi, for example. And so remember, like, the thing, and when people talk about, like, with the New World silver trade, and it's the Spanish control, the South America, and then that goes to the Ming, but it's like, no, it's actually the old, she controlled copper and then very rich silver mines. And then that trade is what that it's old to silver, which is driving the Ming trade as well. So there are sources there. That's what's surprising. It's way more than you would think. It just no one looks for it because we don't know who these people were.
So apart from agriculture, another point that your book argues against is the problem of periodization. And so far in this chat, we have been avoiding using the term warring state period, or I have guiltily used early modern Japan. But can you tell us how your study about the Ōuchi family challenges the periodization of ideas like the warring state period, I guess. Why did you propose a new way of thinking about periodization of this time period, and how do you do so?
So for most people, for example, this idea of, okay, Japanese history, and you have medieval Japan and you have the rise of these powerful shoguns called the Ashikaga, and then it all kind of implodes in this big war called the Onin War, which lasts for a decade. And from 1470s until 1560s, for a century, you have Japan has descended into warring states where every locality is vying for control. And that's kind of the argument. When I was doing my research, I guess that a couple things really surprised me once I look at Western Japan. One is that we always assume that, okay, Kyoto is the center. This is the capital of Japan, and that there aren't many sort of, urban centers elsewhere. And yet what I discovered was very surprising is when this Ōuchi group comes to power in the mid 14th century, they actually create a city and they lay it out. And so that's very unusual. It's not like an organic trading thing, but they have this city. And as time passes, they have a lot of connections with Kyoto. They will intermarry with certain, Kyoto courtier women and so that. And then they start sort of upholding court offices. They get court offices that matter, but then they start bankrolling the court. And often this Onin War period is thought to be a time when like everything's destroyed in the center. And that maybe these people will flee to the West. But what I found is that actually what you have is like major members of the monastic ability, high ranking courtiers, the most important artists like Sesshu and all that, they all go and they leave Kyoto because it was a mess, and they go to Yamaguchi, and there they stay. And Yamaguchi gets large. They clean their streets. They have public toilets. It becomes like a very prosperous settlement. So when you look at Yamaguchi and Kyoto as sort of a segmented polity with these two poles here, you realize that in fact, Kyoto court rites are continuing in Yamaguchi. So even if they're not being performed there, and sometimes these involve like 1,000 monks, these are state rites of the highest order of magnitude, they continue. And then also there's like the most important shrines, in Japan are the Issei shrines, which, and according to standard narrative, they were destroyed and they weren't rebuilt for centuries. And that's another sign of everything not working. Well, in fact, the Ōuchi went through the emperor to get them officially moved to Yamaguchi. So the Issei shrines were in Yamaguchi, not in Issei, for a long time. So once you look at the West, you realize that in fact, this whole polity is functioning, and the Ōuchi use the court as the means for governance. So they don't rely on a warrior regime. They're kind of at arm's length with the warrior regime, but they act like an old-fashioned courtier. And that is very advantageous for trade because in states like Joseon and Korea, they also care about court titles and offices, and so they will get seals, and that will expedite trade with those figures as well. So that's kind of how I'm getting at this. And I found that even the last Ōuchi lord, he basically upholds like all the major court rights, and he pays for them almost entirely himself. And so much so that once things get so bad in the 1550s, and this is one of my most remarkable discoveries, it looks like he tried to then actually move the capital fully to Yamaguchi and just get the emperor out of there. And a lot of these courtiers were very happy, and all the figures, especially what called the Nijo faction of courtiers, were there. But that's when we have a coup and it's destroyed. And so I feel that when the destruction of Yamaguchi really in the 1550s, at the same time, that's a moment where people no longer rely on the court as the means to govern. instead, the court becomes just a facade to legitimate something. And so that's where then later on the court would be like, okay, whatever you want is fine. You know what I mean? And they'd be happy to legitimate everyone. They're just like a rubber stamp, but they weren't that way before. And the court was actually involved in a lot of key policies. Like they promoted the mining as well. And so you see these really interesting ties. And no one thinks that the Japanese court was politically potent at all, but I would say that they were, you know, even at this in this, this through the mid 16th centuries. So when that coup happens and when that collapse happens, then we have a real rupture. And then, so I would say the Warring States period is not the century. It just lasts from around 1551 until about 1568. So it's like 20 years. And when most people learn the stories about the Warring States figures, if you notice, it's all after 1550 because they don't understand that before that time, yes, there were battles. Yes, there was conflicts, but you did not have the whole fundamental order sort of in crisis and the absence of all these rituals and other acts that you had. So that's probably how I see that as a change. And in order to emphasize that, I'll call this the Age of Yamaguchi, which is from the time of the Onin War to 1551. Sorry for the long answer there. It's a lot of stuff.
No, that's very interesting. And that's certainly a new way. I'm all about giving more importance to Western Japan, not them biased or anything. But another interesting topic that you brought up earlier is the issue of ethnicity and religion. So I hope we can talk more about this. Can you tell us more how the issues of ethnicity, especially in the later impact from the Ōchi rule and their civil war on the later time periods and the later, I guess, reception or interpretation of the Ōchi family?
So for my work, there's the University of Vienna scholar Walter Pohl has sort of a notion of ethnicity where the people have a sort of a sense of allegiance to a certain group. They identify as that group, and that group's existence is recognized by others. And so, and what I, you know, originally, again, I'd say that most people had thought that if the Ōchi did, you know, they pretended to be Korean or something like that, they really weren't, and it assumed it'd be more of a facade. But I really discovered, one, they did come from that region, and two, they did emphasize like their sort of Plymouth Rock, where they first came from. There's a place called Tatara Beach. This became the home spot of the Ōchi. And then they've had their prince progenitor, and they moved his grave. And that's where they put these kingly roof tiles in. And so they would even like restore these ancient tombs in the 15th century, which like no one did. So they're very historically minded. And I alluded to this before, and that's when then they would reach out to the Chosun and the Korean officials and ask for more information, and then the Korean officials would recognize it and say, yes, we see that you are of this kingly family house, and then they would get certain key prerogatives, and so they would, you know, and then the Korean accounts say these the Ōchi are Japanese, but they are closest to us. They're very clear about that. And when Korean officials would come through, they would always go in Yamaguchi, and increasingly they would ignore the warrior government and just deal with the Ōchi. And so what I say is that. And it seems like, you know, despite this, the Ōchi have Japanese court ranks. They become very, very prominent courtiers. This dual identity, this distinct ethnicity, actually facilitates a lot of political interactions with both Japan and Korea. And so the Ōchi can make requests of the Japanese court and the Korean court. Even they ask the Korean court to like, you know, rebuild a shrine in Japan because it's important for trade and navigation. So they reach out to states in ways that others don't. And they also do things like they steal the Ashikaga's King of Japan seal so that they use it themselves, even though they're never officially appointed as a King of Japan. What they can do is then they can act as if they are kings, which in East Asian diplomacy means that you are a really important person that could get a lot of trade. So that's why I say how that works. With their destruction, you still see, you know, accounts where the Ōchi will still, their descendants, very few of them, will discuss how they're descended from kings. And the last reference I could find to that's around 1800. But gradually, and this is especially after wars break out between Japan and Korea, I'd say the notion is to kind of sort of look down on Korea and then treat the Ouchi as being kind of exotic, and gradually just to kind of ignore them. And so in the Tokugawa times, they're like, well, they were strange, and they just relied on court things. They were too much involved with court affairs, and that's why they were destroyed. Because in the Tokugawa, the later times, they want to emphasize that only warriors rule, and the court doesn't have any say in rulerships. You see what I mean? So their whole rationale for explaining rule is that warriors always rule, and the court is always just they just write poetry and they never really govern. So they have an interest in kind of de-emphasizing the power of the court. Because the Tokugawa were afraid of the court. You know, the moment they stopped controlling the court, everyone went around the court and, you know, destroyed the Tokugawa. So there's that element. And so also the Ouchi attempt to move the capital is something the Tokugawa feared. So even though accounts will talk about that, you know, that the Ouchi were going to move the emperor in 1551, there's a Tokugawa official history which uses only two sources for that year. Both sources say the Ouchi were trying to move the emperor in 1551. In their account, they don't mention it at all. So it shows you that they really kind of wanted to cover this up. They don't like the idea of a powerful warrior governing through the court. And then I think that just this idea, this sort of this multi-ethnic identity is also something that really kind of falls from favor in Tokugawa times. And so that kind of encourages why a lot of this has been more forgotten.
And I was wondering if you could talk more about this multi-ethnicity part, because I think you mentioned earlier it's not just in the book too. It's not just that their history was forgotten. There was also this kind of effort to actively not mention about the history of the Ouchi. So, how I guess to tie this with contemporary issues even. Especially considering how Zainichi Koreans, so Koreans in Japan, is such a sensitive topic for a lot of people, especially Japanese nationalists. How does the history of the Ouchi family in Japan, how do you see that being contextualized in this whole problem of, well, multi-ethnicity in Japan and the Japanese identity.
Well, I mean, it shows that in the past there weren't clear divisions. There weren't everything was not a binary. It has to be 100% one thing or something else. And so I think that's what's quite important, as well as the fact that the closeness, the fundamental closeness, I'd say, of Japan and Korea, culturally, politically, there are major differences. But I think that one is it's very just good for everyone to realize that those ties. I mean, ironically, when the where you see more Japanese scholarship that with the Ouchis, there was a moment, you know, once you know the Korea was occupied and legally Korea and Japan were unified. You know, I mean, that's what the Japanese rationale was. That's where in some of those cases they would say, look, the Ouchi are a symbol of the fact that the Koreans and the Japanese are one people. You see what I mean? So this is actually during that time, that was an argument which then immediately gets forgotten. Post-war, as the fact that, you know, I mean, the role of the legal role of, and you know, even though they were, you know, occupied by Japan on the same level that the, you know, within the Japanese Empire, Korea had a you know, a privileged position of those states. You know what I mean? If you want to compare, they were legally. I'm not saying there wasn't a pressure or anything like that, but the legal position of Korea was very different from a lot of the other areas. But then as soon as it's over, it's like forgotten foreign state. And I think that what's more important is to just look at these exchanges. And what I found actually is I feel in all really is that I've received so much support and interest in Japan and Korea over this that I do feel that the times are changing and there is it's the Ouchi example or something that you know can show just the fact that these states were close and had a lot of exchanges and I think it's a good thing for all and so I haven't heard anything really negative about it and so there are. bad things that have happened and terrible things, but I also think it's kind of nice to look at a kind of, a shared cultural, political and economic world, and maybe that will help people to realize that these bad episodes are not the norm.
Wonderful. So one thing that I found really fascinating about your book is how from the stories of this one family, you were able to extend beyond and talk about a lot of aspects of the larger significance of this history. So we have, I feel like we have covered the parts about trade and multi-ethnicity. And what other aspects do you mention in the book? And what are some of the other questions on larger significance or impact that your book raises?
Well, one thing is actually about religion, and I find that's actually another crucial theme of the war. And one facet of this is star worship, and that the Oichi worship the North Star. And this is, again, star worship is something you see. It's very common all over East Asia. I mean, everyone worships the North Star, and so certain in many cultures like that. But I do find that that is one really sort of interesting facet. So a lot of what I do is I will follow the Oichi and try to understand how we understand Japanese religion. And one thing that I will maybe emphasize is the Ōuchi family themselves have this kind of possessiveness over religious institutions. They want to own them. They want to make them their own. And so what they do is, that's like I talked about the Issei shrines, like they move them there so they could see him from their mansion, and then they put the Ōuchi crest right there. But every shrine they control, they will rebuild it. So Usa in Kyushu, Hakozaki in Kyushu, the Issei shrines, Itsukushima shrine with the famous torii in the water, they actually gain control of that. And they're the ones that restore the big gate in the water in the 1540s. And if you ever go there, there's actually, it's really great because there's the sign for the it survives from the Ōuchi times. And so you see Itsukushima Shrine, and it's written by the calligraphy of the emperor, and then it's covered in copper plates, by the way, because to symbolize how the court and the Ōuchi were working with copper and revitalizing that. And the Ōuchi crest in copper is there on that. So what you can see is that they really do try to control all these various sort of, religious institutions, and they're fairly successful about it. So they'll repurpose a national shrine to an Ōuchi shrine. And that also goes into how they still emphasize the rites and rituals of Yamaguchi, but they do in their own way kind of undermine the state too. You know what I mean? That's what I'd say. And then also when we talk about belief, they worship stars, they patronize Buddhism, Tendai Buddhism in particular, and its esoteric Buddhism has links to northern stars. But also when you have the Yoshida Shinto, which is like a revitalization, or where Shinto as a belief, a lot of scholars will argue is Shinto as we know it, as a distinct belief system, as a religion, if you want to call that, it really only comes into being in the 15th century. And nationalists have run with Yoshida Shinto, so it's thought to be like, this is the beginning of state Shinto and everything bad. But what's fascinating is that the Ōuchi have a very key role with these Yoshida people. And the Yoshida people used to support the Ashikaga and the people in the court, and then they're like, hey, we could support you, the Ōuchi. And one thing that they do is, and I find really interesting, is that they glorify one of the Ōuchi leaders as a god. And this happens in 1488. And why that's fascinating is that this before in Japanese religion, there was this notion kind of if someone is really wronged, they become what's called an onryo, or an evil spirit. And that's something really scary. And the higher the status, the more power they had, and if they're really upset, the worse damage they can do. And sometimes emperors know this. One emperor got exiled, and so he just used his own blood to write curses like all the time. And everyone's like, oh no, it's become an evil spirit. And sure enough, for the next century, they blamed every disaster on this guy. So it was common then to say, okay, this person will make him into a god, make him happy so that he won't cause havoc. But there's another style, and this is what's more common in later centuries, where they use the term a daimyojin, or like a light-emitting deity. And these ones weren't wrong spirits. They're more like, this is just someone awesome, and we will go and make them a god. And there's this very specific, this being Japan, a very specific bureaucratic process by which you have to apply for someone to become a god, and the Yoshida shrine specialist has to sign on it, off in it. The emperor has to give it his okay, and then the person can officially become a god. That happens with one of the Ōchi lords. The son does it for his father, and the guy was not wronged in any way. And what's really interesting is that that becomes the template for the deification of other great figures. So that later on, there's a figure, Hideyoshi, who becomes known as the Toyokuni Daimyojin. They followed the exact same administrative process to make him a god that they did for the Ōchi beforehand. And then, you know, the Toshogu is a variation of that, where they emphasize Buddhism as opposed to the Yoshida Shinto. But I think that the religion side of it also shows that a lot of the things we assume to be early modern, you know, like this idea is Japan becomes early modern, you have to have absolutist figures who gain control, and they do this by declaring themselves to be gods. And I can show that actually happened a century earlier and it's been totally forgotten. So I do feel that it undermines a lot of things about how we see Japan, religion, its trade, its role in the world. And so I would say I would like to emphasize that's probably one of the things we really haven't talked about, but is quite integral to the book.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. There are a lot of details we haven't got to cover in this chat, but I hope this will make our listeners more curious and to read the books.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for our listeners for staying with us. This was Dr. Thomas Collin and his new book, Kings in All But Name, The Lost History of Ōchi Rule in Japan, 1350 to 1569. It's currently available in hardcover and ebook. I am Jeannie Lee. Stay tuned for our next episode, and goodbye for now.